I'm Tammy Vindonge, your host for Executive with a Cause. Today on the show, I welcome Brett Wilson, the Chief Information Officer of Red Cross Australia. Today, we're going to chat about the good, bad, and hard things about running a charity. Brett, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tammy. Really happy to be here today.
I think it's been probably 15 years ago that we were working together at Capgemini, one of the big IT global IT companies. Has it been that long?
It has been a long time, and I think we've all moved on from Capgemini and moved into different things, and I think moving to both into the not-for-profit space now.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have this conversation with you. I think just to start off, I know a lot of people are familiar with the Red Cross brand, obviously, but given the services that you're providing in Australia, it would be really good to provide more context as to what services you're supporting there.
Yeah, thanks, Tammy. So Red Cross in Australia is broken up into two specific areas, one being the lifeblood, which is obviously where they have a series of donation platforms and areas and provide blood to Australia, and the other is the humanitarian side. So I work on the humanitarian side where we provide relief for emergencies, disasters, and community support. And so our core mission is around how do we provide an increase in impact for humanitarian effort. And so that's the side that I work on. And we're part of a 192 national societies across the globe. And that's underneath the Red Cross brand.
And for Red Cross Australia, is it a centralized management or centralized IT function, or is it something that's dispersed across the different states and territories?
We operate as a centralized IT function. About 10 years ago, we moved away from that sort of federated, decentralized model into the centralized model. And the key reason for that was to try and leverage off the economies of scale and not have to have a team in every location to run technology.
Okay, that's quite useful to know. So how did you get involved in Red Cross?
I'd been through corporate for my whole life, and I had set up an initiative around caravans for bushfires back in 2020 when the bushfires were on. So managed to secure 15 or 16 caravans that were donated, and then we stocked them up and took them down to people who'd lost their houses. And at that time, I was thinking, well, I've worked for corporates. How can I actually produce, how do I provide more good back into the community? And Red Cross came up, and I had a number series of conversations to really understand where Red Cross was, where they were obviously planning to move to. And it was a really exciting time to join into Red Cross at that time, because they were on the edge of thinking, well, we need to transform the organization. And I think for me, it was how do I overlay my skill set to really create more good and from a humanitarian perspective.
And so this is not your first CIO role before, but I have a feeling that some of the people in our organization, our listeners in particular, aren't even familiar with what the CIO does. Can you talk more about that role and how it might be different from the corporate world that you've come from to what you're doing at Red Cross now?
Yeah, sure. So my role, effectively, it's not a technical role. I have an understanding from a technology perspective to sort of keep everyone a little bit honest. But overall, my role is looking forward. How do we spend time out in the organization? So I spend probably 60 to 70% of my time out in the organization, actually understand where the business challenges are, trying to understand and influence parts of the organization to make sure that we are putting in the right technology to help them address and achieve their business goals as well. I have an amazing team underneath me that run the technology pieces, security, planning and architecture, and sort of digital as well. So they run the technical pieces. And for me, it's about understanding how do we move forward and how do we leverage off technology to create more impact from a humanitarian perspective, but also working with our partners as well, and making sure that we end up with a technology stack that enables the organization to achieve its goals.
And how big is your team?
We're a team of just shy of 60 at the moment.
60
FTEs.
Okay. Yep. All right. That's a big
and
team.
So we support around about 2,000 staff across Red Cross, and we also have about 25,000 volunteers and I think about 6,000 members. So it's a big organisation when you add all of the, all of those people together, and very different needs from those three sort of categories as well, whereas the sort of FTE staff are, we will react to an emergency that happens on the ground. We'll pull in volunteers as we need to as well. So the recent floods, we activated 500 people across 52 evacuation centres. And but then we run a series of 160 retail stores as well. So we use volunteers and staff to use those. But not to forget also as well is our members are a really important piece of Red Cross. And they get together and run community events as well. So how do we provide the technology to keep them engaged with Red Cross to make sure that they understand what's going on, but also keep involved in obviously what our mission and our objective is?
I'm dying to jump into the stack itself, but I feel like that should be lower priority at the moment. It's such a huge organization, like you said. The crisis management piece, in particular from an IT perspective, when you may not have electricity, when you may not have mobile coverage, I can only imagine how difficult and challenging that might be. And then you also have, you know, the back office work. The organization itself is big enough to have a full IT organ support, but a lot of the not-for-profits that are out there that I work with, and even some of the larger ones, not quite as large as yours, but you know, larger ones, don't actually have CIOs or anyone strategic that can help with those investment decisions. And what are some of the things that these organizations should consider for the future, I suppose, if, because everybody has to invest at some point in IT, and a lot of them are very reactive to that.
Really good question. Probably the first thing would be, what is the objective for the organization? What's the strategy? You can't really, it's technology second, strategy first. Once you've got an understanding of the overarching strategy and how the organization wants to, where they are at the moment and where they want, what they want to achieve, then it's about looking at the technology that can help them achieve that and enable them to achieve that goal. It's probably, if you go back to the CEO or the investment board or whoever you actually need to go back to and say, well, I need to do these specific projects, the first question that I would ask would be, how does it help us achieve our organizational strategy to deliver that? If it doesn't, it's really hard to actually get that by. So I think that'd be the first thing I'd say, to be able to roll it up and roll it back down. The second probably thing would be is, it's not about chasing the latest shiny thing. It's about making sure that you can add the most amount of value for the funding and the resources you have. And then the third piece, I think, is really, how do you leverage partners as much as possible? A lot of the large tech companies have NFP pricing as well as additional support. It's really important you can leverage off those, and it doesn't matter whether you're a small not-for-profit or a large one. We all still get the same sort of set of pricing and everything else. So it's really important you tap into those, but they will also provide additional support and potentially some resourcing to help you use their tools better to achieve obviously the goals of the organization.
Do you leverage these partners for volunteers in the IT space at all?
We do in some areas. So we've partnered up with a number of organizations we're looking at running a hackathon in the next couple of months. So partnering up with a number of organizations to help us look at some of our more gnarly problems and work through on how we can provide either a better technical solution, or it might be just some really smart people in a room to come up with better ideas than obviously what we can think of as well. So we do leverage off that. Longer term, what I'd really love to do is tap into that volunteer community, but from a technical perspective, so we can experiment a bit more around technology without having to use internal resources.
When you look at the different industries in terms of adaption, you know, you usually have the tech, fintech sector first. You have the big IT companies are generally around that space as well. You oftentimes go to manufacturing and a few other like retail, and then you have government, and then not-for-profit is always last when it comes to adoption. So what's it like coming from the private sector as a CIO and then moving into not-for-profits?
I think the key, the key thing that you, that changes in the mindset is that the money that I spend is the money that we can't then go to produce the thing that we do that adds value on the ground. So if I was to go into the board and say, I'd really like X amount of money to go and run a new ERP system, it would then be a question of, in my back of my mind, around, well, I'm going to take that money away from providing impact on the ground. So I think that's the key thing. In terms of being, I think, laggards, look, our environment is, we have around about 200 applications across our environment at the moment. There's been a lot of things added on over the last 10 or 15 years that's created an environment which is probably a lot more complex than we need to be. So I think one of the reasons that we are a little bit laggard in that sort of technology stack is that there's no real, and this probably really comes back to that strategic planning, there's no real thought around what's the next 3 to 5 years look like and what am I seeing out in the industry. It's more, I have a need now and I'm going to plug something in that's going to address that need. So I think it's really important if we are going to sort of start raising really the digital technology stack and shifting away from the laggards, maybe up a level above maybe government, to give us more value, but provide that simpler sort of system that's not complex. There's a tendency to create complex things because we believe we do things differently, and some things we may, but I think there's only a small fraction of where we need to leverage off something you've built versus something you can get off the shelf.
I'm thinking about a number of clients that I have right now, and because of the realities that it is so easy just to buy an application online with a credit card, because it is so easy to even employ low code type software that you can create yourself, there's a tendency for, especially the bigger the organization is, the more likely that there might be what's called a shadow IT. Now, we might have to define that for the audience, which is largely businesses basically has its IT, or performing IT functions in some degree, and often without the IT team even knowing about it. How do you provide the governance to ensure that these types of things don't happen, so you do have full management, especially when you do have a CIO in your organization?
So I'm going to share a number now, which is a little bit scary at the start. When I first started here, we had 89% shadow IT. That means 11% of the systems and platforms were managed by tech, and 89% were basically managed outside of any governance and control. So where we've now brought in the people, the process, the tech over the last 18 months that I've been with Red Cross, and we're now at a point where we understand what we have. And it is a little bit of a mess because there's been no forethought around connecting these things together. Citizen development or development outside of IT is okay, as long as you can provide the boundaries and the guardrails to say, these are the things, the areas you need to work within. So security is a non-negotiable. These are the things that have to be in place if we're going to go and develop something externally. These are the specific methodologies we're going to follow, or if we're doing specific things around coding or something like that, these are the areas you have to follow. So I think it's about, the reason that shadow IT exists is because IT is actually not providing them with the tools that they need to actually do their jobs.
Mm-hmm. And what percentage, or what's your view on the fact that in some organizations there is still a need for them to have like business administrators, possibly system administrators, actually sitting within the business function? What's your view on that?
I think it's good having someone sitting out in the business, because if you embrace them as well and bring them into virtual forums or working groups, you get an insight into that function in that area, and so much more visibility than you normally would have had in maybe you're going and meeting them with a meeting and they tell you a little bit, whereas this person is immersed into that area. I think it goes back to that governance piece, making sure that there are the guardrails and everyone knows what those guardrails are, and they're in place to make sure that they don't do something that will end up either a data breach or something else like that.
And understanding the cybersecurity governance piece, but what about data? Like I often find that when you have the business running IT, data could be all over the place with very little visibility from a holistic point of view.
data is one of our challenges as well. We as I mentioned, we have over 200 applications. We have data within, it's kind of like a bay of disconnected islands of data. And we have little bridges between some of them, and we have nothing between some of them, and they sit out here. It's a hard one, because you need to go back to that governance piece around what's that central source of truth. Where is that specific master data sitting that's over here that might feed into another platform or system? The challenge is when you come up with two sources of truth, which one is the source of truth? Because, and you're reporting off one, and you're reporting off the other one, and they provide two different sets of reporting. That's when you have to go back into, well, where is that source of truth? Let's agree that is the source of truth. And if possible, integrate either via API or something else. Or if worst case scenario is you then start pulling in information via Excel or some other sort of format as well. But I think it's really important to go back into what are and identify what are the sources of truth. So finance information, where are you reporting from? You're not pulling things out to Excel and then manipulating information as well. But if you've got two sources of truth for one specific set of data, I would go back and figure out which one is the right one to rely off. And that's unfortunately a discussion that needs to be had with the other party that has what they think is a source of truth as well. So it is a bit of an influence process where you go to two parties and you figure out which is the right one. And then obviously the other one unfortunately misses out.
I think the bigger the organization, the harder that is too, or the more likely that's going to happen. You know, the smaller organizations are like, I only have one source of truth right now, but it does happen for sure in the bigger ones. From a governance point of view, do you guys have any, or can you talk about like any kind of steering committees or anything that you have set up right now to help manage the overall future of IT and then putting these frameworks in place?
Yep. So when I first started, IT weren't really engaging with the organization, hence why we ended up with that 89% of shadow IT. So we recognized there was a need for a formal process to make sure that IT are engaging with the organization, but vice versa as well, and things didn't come in at the last minute. So what we'd set up was a series of working groups. So we have working groups for one for data, one for volunteering, one for finance, one for HR, and they don't just have HR people and finance people, and we have cross-organization people in them. So within the data working group, we have a representative from each area of the organization. So they talk about the things that are obviously concerning as well, and goes back to that point around they have the discussion within the working group around where central sources of truth are coming from as well. But also what it means is they will set the priorities for data coming up, and that goes up into a steering committee, and then the steering committee can adjust based on priorities and resources. But it means that the business is actually deciding what are the priorities coming through rather than IT. If IT try and force priorities down, and if from a technical perspective, that's great. But if IT try and force priorities back down into the business, that's when you get most of the pushback. So we found this works really well because we still have a seat on the table, but it's the business making the decision, and we're engaging better. We're getting more information coming through these working groups than we've had before, but it also enables us to plan better because we've got visibility of the working groups through the steering committee.
And I imagine with the prioritization that's not always a easy vote. There's probably a lot of people that have their own projects that they want to put to the head of the list. What kind of process do you have for when people are suggesting new projects or upgrades or any kind of additional functionality?
It all goes back to alignment to strategy. Which of the projects or initiatives that are going to help us achieve that strategy? So part of the strategy might be increasing revenue, because we obviously can't do anything without funding. So if there is a revenue piece that comes through, then we'll obviously look at that probably ahead of something that might be a nice to have that we're going to do from a back-end perspective and reporting. It also comes back to availability of resources. We have a finite amount of resources to do things. And so we obviously do a planning forecast 6 to 8 weeks out. And so what that means is we may not have the resources for the next 6 to 8 weeks. We've got a backlog that that goes on for the next 12 to 18 months. And so I think it's a mixture of what's the alignment to the organizational strategy to enable it to achieve that. And the second piece is, do we have available resources or funding to actually do this? But the first question is, where is the funding coming from?
So would you have different buckets for funding?
We've now brought all of the tech funding back into one area.
Okay.
But it's tagged into specific functions. So marketing will have a bucket within there that's within the IT budget, and they can't spend that without obviously making sure that they've got alignment in there to they've got the funding. So then we've got finance, which is actually underneath my budget as well. Same thing, we've got it tagged as finance. So whilst they have funding, it still needs to go through an approval process. They can't just go and buy something off the shelf.
Okay, so let's talk about resources a little bit. I know you mentioned partners before, and you have 60 staff working for you. What kind of skill sets do you have in-house, and which kind of skill sets do you leverage from partners?
At the moment, in-house, we've got, so the domains we have are security. We have operations, so your Microsoft 365 infrastructure networks. Then we have architecture and planning. So within that space, we've got a mixture of business analysts, solution architects, and platform owners. And then we've got the delivery area, which is where we effectively do all of the development and the configuration that we roll out to the organization. So if you look at the split across that, security and architecture and planning are probably the smallest, and operations at the moment is probably the second biggest, and then you've got delivery, and within that team there's probably about 25 to 30. And so we do a lot of internal development, and the reason we do a lot of internal development still is we have a lot of legacy applications, and we don't have a choice to go out to partners to do this. So we have a lot of people working on more break fix. And as we transform away from legacy applications, we'll shift that team to probably a more right-sized team where we've got a mixture of team internally, as well as we leverage off our partners as well. And the partnership piece is really important. We do, say, for example, our digital MR tech stack. We have a small amount of resources that do it internally, but we leverage off partners about 80% for that. Within some of the other areas, such as development for SharePoint or some of those areas, we're actually leveraging off our, we've got an offshore component as well. And so we use those team members to actually develop while we're respectively asleep. And then it comes back in and we push it back into production on our side there as well. So if I had to sort of pick a percentage of what it would be, is we do about probably 60 to 70% internally and about 30% externally.
Let's talk about that offshore component, because I think that's a very unique way to access resources. Is the resources you're talking about, are they specific to your software development piece or for some of your other things?
At the moment, it's just software development. And the reason we chose to go offshore is, as everyone would be understanding at the moment, there's a bit of a war on talent. So we are losing resources to go to and work for corporates, because we just don't have the funding to pay someone the amount that the corporates are paying. So we need to look things a little bit differently. And we could get a really good resource or a staff member or team member over in Vietnam that can do some amazing things for us at a lower cost. And we can't do it for everything, because we have restrictions around access to information and production data. But it gave us an opportunity to continue the work rather than outsourcing it to or giving it to a someone within Australia, which was going to cost a significant amount more. So it goes back to using the resources that you have more efficiently than, and maybe breaking the mold a little bit here, because I don't think there's a lot of NFPs that are actually offshoring. And so for me, it was how do we use those resources more effectively, and I can get, and there is a cost factor in as well. So I can get three resources potentially, whereas if I had have outsourced it in Australia, I would have got probably an outcome, but it would have cost me three times as much.
There is also additional costs though by going offshore. One is, you do have to manage them, and sometimes differently. I've noticed from my own experience that it's not always the most efficient way, depending on how good their skills are as well. Like sometimes it takes them a lot longer to complete a task that may have been done faster. So how do you both hire and also manage individuals that may be in a different country?
So we've run through an organization who I've dealt with before. And so they will effectively, they provide office space. They provide the your laptop, your hardware. They do all the HR support, and they are part of the process of recruitment. So we will give them a specific set of criteria to say, we need them to have these skills. And obviously comms is a really important piece as well. So they need to be able to communicate effectively with the team here. The way we've got around the disconnection or the management piece is they're part of our team. We don't treat them any differently. They're just part of our team. They just happen to sit in another location. And that's worked really well. So we haven't had to have a management layer over the top, because they effectively are just working from a different location that happens to be a 14-hour plane ride away.
And what about your domestic team? Are they all based in Sydney?
A mixture of Sydney and Melbourne, Sydney, Melbourne, but we're back in the office 2 days a week at this point in time. And we're looking further afield out of just Sydney and Melbourne as we go through sort of challenges around hiring people we've just hired a new head of IT security in Wollongong. And so the agreement is he'll come up once a fortnight and spend some time with the team. And we're also looking further afield across the country to determine how do we get the best bang for our buck for resources, and getting really good resources who are really committed to actually making sure that we can achieve our mission and our goal as well, and understanding what that purpose is and the connection back into Red Cross.
It's interesting that one of your key components is to build a security team internally. I find that most not-for-profits do not have the capacity or the capability to do that. So they tend to outsource the security piece, or they should consider that. I wonder if you might be able to provide some advice for other organizations around their management of cybersecurity. That's obviously a huge risk. We were just talking about it this morning here in Australia. Recently, one of the major phone companies has been breached. And I was just telling you that this morning I also had an email from the private health insurance providers that said that they were just breached. So this is happening very frequently, and also in the not-for-profit space too. Would you mind providing some advice around this?
Look, I mean, security, it's one of these things that you're never going to get to 100% secure. I think that's a given. It's about how do you protect that really sensitive information that of the vulnerable people that we're helping? And we are obviously governing around making sure that we can put the right technical controls in place as well. But looking out across the horizon now, we have a relatively small security team. So we had a head of IT security and two analysts that sit underneath them and a PCI compliance team member as well. And then we outsource our SIEM and our SOC. And so what that gives us
is... You're going to have to define that.
All right. So Security Operations Center. and the SIEM is associated with that as well. But what it means is they have overall transparency across our organization of the thousands and thousands of security logs that are coming through. They will then make a decision on whether they can act, or whether we should act as well, on something that's coming through. So then it'll go back into the internal team, the analysts in the internal team, to look at it and say, well, Brett's been doing something over here. Maybe we should look into it. What it means is you're not sitting there looking at thousands and thousands of logs, but you get that capability. And a lot of organizations now are providing that at a really low cost. So it shouldn't be a barrier to use it. I would recommend to at least get something in place so you can start getting transparency. The board of any organization now, whether they be not-for-profit or corporate, is really interested around security and how we're protecting the organization. If you walk into a meeting and say, we've actually got some information here and this is what we think we need to do to protect us and uplift our security, they're more likely to listen rather than, oh, we just think this is a really good thing to do. So I think it goes back to using the data associated with maybe that we can bring together with some metrics, and you can use that then to go to the board potentially to uplift security as well. But it is an area which is a concern as well. And Red Cross from the humanitarian side had a data breach back in 2020, and it came back to misconfigured systems. And so it's not just a matter of securing the data, it's about making sure that you're the way that you're doing things and the way that you're actually configuring systems is secure as well.
And this goes back to whether or not you're hosting things yourself and you're managing things yourself. Before we got on the call, you mentioned the fact that at least you've moved everything off your own servers in-house and you've moved to the cloud. Can you talk about that decision a bit?
That was the decision that was made before I'd started, but I'm happy to talk about it. So we had risks associated with aging infrastructure. We had a number of servers, sort of 100 odd servers sitting out in a data center, where we had to make a decision around, did we replace those servers? So we had virtual infrastructure sitting on top of those servers, or did we shift to a temporary location, which was a more infrastructure in the cloud? So decision was made at that time to lift and shift that entire environment. I think it was, over 200 servers into AWS. And so that's just finished, I think, in June this year. So huge effort from the team to try and get us from obviously physical back into infrastructure as a service. It addressed one issue, which was the aging infrastructure. The risk, though, is still there, because all we've done is lifted and shifted. We've added things on, and there's really simple things you can do to address some of the risks associated with obviously cloud as well, as single sign-on. As well as MFA, so multi-factor authentication, which are all part of the Google and Microsoft suite. So really simple things you can turn on to protect either legacy things that you have or anything that's available externally.
There's a lot of debate right now about the method of moving to the cloud, whether or not you just do a lift and shift, like you said, which is usually cheaper in the short term for a transition point of view, but also it doesn't necessarily add capability or the ability for staff to find information when you do it that way. How's that impacted the business? And also, just to be really transparent, cost, because I know a lot of organizations have been surprised by the hosting costs when they're just doing a lift and shift.
It's a bit of you do get bill shock. The cost for AWS after the shift is probably, I would say, more than what we were originally obviously paying for hosting. It's not, moving to cloud doesn't necessarily reduce your costs. Moving to cloud gives the opportunity to then move, so it moves you away from the physical infrastructure, so if you need maintenance, etc. But it doesn't necessarily reduce costs. Then moving outside of that cloud to another cloud is relatively expensive. So you need to think, is that where I'm going to end up, or am I going to use this as an interim? So for us, it was AWS at the moment, where we've got all of our older legacy infrastructure running, is an interim until we start shifting to public cloud services, so SaaS services. I would really look into the T's and C's around what is it to transition out rather than the cost to transition in and then run, because they are generally higher than obviously running.
So just to go into a little more detail about that, I think some of our listeners may not understand that basically you just move the data and the systems and such over at this time. But what you just mentioned there was at some point moving from the legacy systems to some more cloud-based software. You mentioned to me before the show also that you're starting to look at a transformation, I think you called it a foundational transformation. Are you able to talk about that at all?
Yeah, sure. So we've just been to the board recently and put a proposal forward to look at simplifying the organization. So as I mentioned, we have 200 odd applications. They're all running between, we've got point solutions for integration. So every time we do an upgrade to one system, we then need to go and check all these other systems as well. So for us, it was how do we take a step back? And if we were to almost reimagine what the future would look like for Red Cross from a technology stack perspective, what could it look like? Now we're going down a platform approach. And so for us, we're looking at Dynamics 365 for a number of reasons. One, it's a great product. The second is Microsoft have a number of not-for-profit accelerators that sit on there, so for fundraising. And they have an entire area that actually is dedicated to not-for-profits. And so that was one of the reasons of going down the platform approach. So for us, it will be finance system or ERP. We'll then look at CRM around contact management, looking at HRIS because we don't have an HRIS system at the moment. So how do we manage our people more effectively? Then looking into some of the other areas such as the marketing stack. How do we leverage off the marketing stack to engage better with our donors and obviously with anyone who that we deal with to one, bring them back in to connect with the brand, but also how do we engage with them better to maybe try and convince them that shifting from a single giver donor to maybe a regular donor and connecting with the brand and our mission is a better thing as well. Overarching of that or overlaying over the top of that is security. So nothing happens without the security piece that starts at the start. One, how we're going to protect the data. And then two, who has access to that data longer term? Because we connect into a number of different systems and platforms like governments. And so we need to make sure that their data is secure, but obviously what we're feeding to them as well. So that's kind of where we are at the moment. We're still on early days of that. We were hoping to kick off in the next month or so. But it's a 12 to 18 month plan where we are literally reimagining and the whole foundational piece of our organization from a tech stack that will then set us up for the future so we can leverage off that tech stack and technology as well.
For an organization of your size, I was kind of surprised when you said you didn't have an HR system. That's got to be, I can't imagine how difficult that work must be without that.
Look, as soon as we spoke to our HR team, they're chomping at the bit to get something in. We haven't made a decision on the platform for HR at this stage. We're still going through some views around that. But we're using payroll at the moment as a bit of a pseudo HR system. And so for 2,000 employees, it kind of works for some things, but it doesn't give us the transparency into our employees and doesn't give us the visibility of that central source of truth for our Red Cross people who work for us on a daily basis.
And I'm also thinking about all the manual processes that must be going on in the background to manage a team of that size. What are you using for payroll?
Orion.
Orion. Okay. It's always interesting to share, obviously these are kind of the larger platforms that the smaller not-for-profits may not consider at all, but it's always good to just share and talk about that. And it's interesting to know you're going to Dynamics. Are you thinking about also adopting Business Central for their finance system?
Yeah, so for us, it will be finance and operations, which is, I think, F&O. Yeah. And so definitely, obviously, adopting that for ERP as well. One thing you mentioned then, which was around manual processing. We have a significant amount across the organization around manual processing. So we've been dabbling around using RPA, so robotic process automation, since last year. We've now got 5 bots running. And so what it means for us is we can almost automate what a human person does. So we look at 2 systems where we were, a really good example is our cash grant system. We had one person sitting there and all they were doing was moving information between 2 legacy systems because we couldn't connect them. We're now using RPA on that. And I think the saving was around, just to do the grants applications, if we were to run the New South Wales floods in Queensland appeal like we did back in June, we'd save around 1,800 days of admin time.
Wow.
And then the payment side, that was the automation, I think, of around about 8 points in an 11-step process. Then around the payment side as well is there's checks and balances and things that need to move around. We've automated some of the manual processing and that. And another 451 days of saving of either we would need to bring in volunteers or we would need to pay someone to do it. What it also means is we can speed it up because bots run 24 hours a day, whereas people can only run realistically 8 hours a day. So we had bots running 24 hours a day for the whole time that we ran that through. And then we started looking to other areas such as COVID vaccinations. And to check the COVID vaccinations for 2,000 staff is obviously a significant amount, but then you add all of our volunteers and members on, and there's just no way that we could have done it. So what we did was it literally does a scan across the certificate and just checks 8 points and then gives you a score back. And if it was over a certain amount, then it went as checked and obviously verified. It was under a certain amount, then someone physically checked it. What that meant is we can then look at things by exception. And if you look across the organization around manual processing, and we're using automation anywhere for our RPA, but you can use Power Apps, you can use other things from the Microsoft stack or from obviously the tech partner they're using. And there's options to refine and increase things. I was talking to someone yesterday, the CIO of Woolworths, not the CIO of Woolworths, he heads up a specific area. And he was saying that they've started obviously automating so many things within their finance piece that was manual processing. And for us, we still receive checks for donations. So one of the areas there is how do we scan in a check and then pull out the information without someone having to manually key it in, because then you get errors as well. So it improves obviously the processing time, but it stops the errors.
So a new set of skills, and I know there's a lot of not-for-profits that are very interested in this space right now. So you said, Power Apps is a common one. Zapier is a one between known applications. Do you have actually a team that's actually doing that? Because that's a different set of skills.
We have one person who's sort of doing it on the side of their desk at the moment. It's not it's a capability we need to start developing. But it was really what we needed to do at the start was really show the value in it. And I think with these 5 bots running and every time you donate to one of our appeals, so Ukraine appeal at the moment that's running, it will actually use the bot in the background. But we don't have a big team associated with it. We are looking to build up that capability, but it was about, and I think going back to that point around, you need to show the value to get the additional funding. Don't ask for the funding and then say, I'll give you the value. Do something small at the start and then build it up into something and then ask obviously for additional funding if you can.
And such an emerging capability that it's actually really hard to find these people right now locally. So it might be something else that you have to send overseas just because it's very difficult to find these kind of resources at the moment.
Yeah, for sure. It is. Especially obviously with, as we spoke about at the start, the tech industry now is really hot around from a market perspective. So it's hard to try and get resources at a price point that we can actually afford.
And I suppose that's also why a lot of people don't have CIOs, is because they see it as a nice to have. What would be your advice for organizations that may not have invested in resources or even training of staff? What's your view on... Or what's your advice to other not-for-profits that may be considering more investment into their IT team right now?
I think if you look at the way that organizations are changing now, every organization runs on technology. You can't do something without touching technology. If you don't have the right team involved to run the technology on a day-to-day basis and they're trained up appropriately, you will end up spending more time because you've got something that's not fit for purpose. If you spend the time training up your team and obviously making sure that they've got the ability to go out and look in the horizon forward, and obviously my role as a CIO is that forward thinking. What's it look like on the next horizon, the horizon after that? Whereas you can either leverage off a CIO and bring someone in as a virtual CIO or as a bring someone in to provide a strategy or a technology strategy for you as well. But my view is if you don't start investing in technology and the security as well, you will end up spending more time manual processing and you'll end up spending the time and the money associated with a lot more then rather than actually bringing someone in who can help you and or training the team up so they can do something effectively, but understand what the future could look like. Because if you've got a team that actually is trained up, they will come with more ideas and more thoughts around how do we refine some process or how do we do things better. If they're not appropriately trained, you will still do things, some great things, but you could probably achieve so much more with people with the right skills and looking forward as well.
I think terrific advice for any not-for-profit and even for those that are not. Brett, I know we're running out of time here. Is there any final pieces of advice that you'd like to provide to other charities and not-for-profits?
Probably the key thing would be is go out and work in the business for a little while and the organization. Go out and spend some time. Like for us, we've got Red Cross shops. We've got volunteering opportunities. So my plan is to still get the team to go out and spend some time. It's not just sitting in your office or sitting in at home. Make sure you engage with other parts of the organization because they're your best advocates. You're really enabling them to be successful in achieving their goals. So make sure you go out and spend some time and build up those relationships with areas outside of the organization or outside of your specific area that you normally wouldn't. That's probably the key piece of advice that I would say. And it's the hardest as well.
Well, the engagement piece, isn't it? IT is no longer just a help desk. They're actually a business partner if you want to utilize them well. So I think that's a good way to share and also just good advice in general.
I was going to say the one last piece in that, I think in there is build a roadmap or a strategy and share it with everybody. Because the thing that I've seen is we build technology teams, build these fantastic strategies, but don't share them with anyone. It's a really key point because what you want is to be able to walk into a room with the head of finance or maybe one of the board members, and they know what's going on. Whereas if you bring this strategy and say, we've been working on this forever, it doesn't have to be perfect. You just need to get something in place and get some input from areas outside of IT.
And I suppose for those that don't have an IT strategist or someone who's in that more strategic role, the idea is that you do need a strategy for this space.
Correct. Yeah, definitely. You've got to, it all starts with a plan and the plan can change, but you've got to start with something. You've got to start sharing it out. And you've got to be open to suggestions around it's not quite right because the people you're actually developing this for know far more and are more experienced in their area of expertise than you are. So you need to be open to suggestions as well.
Yeah, great advice. Brett, if people want to support Red Cross Australia, what's the best way to do that?
If you go to the website, so redcross.org.au, and down the bottom, there's a donation area. Obviously, if you wanted to donate against a specific appeal, you can also volunteer if you want to come and volunteer in any of our retail stores, as well as we do a lot of community programs as well. So through the website, you can join into some of those community programs, which run across nationally across the globe as well.
And also, I have a feeling there's going to be a few people that want to reach out and touch you. Is LinkedIn the best way to do that?
Yeah, definitely. Look, find me on LinkedIn, Brett Wilson on there. And so you'll find me on there and just drop me a message. More than happy to have a chat or if you need a bit of a hand with something or to bounce an idea off, just drop me a message.
Beware. You might get a lot of conversations around that manual process issue. Brett, it's been wonderful to have this conversation with you. After maybe 30 episodes nearly, I haven't had this conversation with a CIO yet. And I think that this is a real deficit in most organizations is their capability and investment within, for not-for-profits within the IT space is causing a lot of pain and a lot of risk right now. So having this conversation with you and talking about some of the work that you and your team are doing and planning to do is just such good knowledge for them to understand that actually they're not alone. You still have manual process issues. You still have risk. You still have data issues. So even though they might be smaller, that it's still a common occurrence and there's still ways to solve this. So just thank you for that work that you guys do and thanks for sharing today.
Thanks, Tammy. Look, thank you for having me as well.
Hi, this is Tammy again. When I'm not doing podcasts, I'm helping not-for-profits with IT decisions. The question for this week's IT in Plain English segment is, what is the metaverse? The word metaverse has been used a lot lately. Facebook has even changed their parent company name to Meta to reflect their future vision in the metaverse. However, the definition of this word is not standardly used. Neither are its potential benefits nor opportunities fully understood. But in the simplest sense, the metaverse is kind of like a new virtual reality through an emerging set of technologies like the blockchain or non-fungible tokens. I'll explain these words in other episodes. Some describe it as a video game where you can interact with other people, businesses, and organizations, but as yourself rather than as a fictional character. That means you can buy things and you can prove that you own things, such as assets. That's why companies like Coca-Cola and Nike are jumping in with their own digital products. Now, while it may feel like more of a passing trend, after all, you can't drink a virtual Diet Coke. Some not-for-profits are actually starting to experiment with the metaverse, specifically to fundraise. In reality, the possibilities for the future of the metaverse are not fully envisioned by anyone yet. What is likely is that you'll be hearing a lot more about this word in the next few years. So, if you're an innovative organization, it may be worth exploring opportunities in the metaverse. So there you have it, in plain English. If you have an IT question you want answered, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn and send me a message. I just might answer it on the show. And if you liked what you've heard, please subscribe and leave me a review. To all of you executives with a cause, the world is definitely a better place because of you. Thank you for what you and your teams do every day.